Welcome to Witch Hunt, the leading podcast on the witch trials of the past and the continued witch hunts of today. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack.
We're descendants of women accused of witchcraft.
And we're here to tell stories of people like them.
In this episode, we're talking to Dr. Tricia Pione about witchcraft accusations in New Hampshire.
In 1648, Jane Walford became the first New Hampshire woman to be accused of witchcraft. Learn what happened to her and the others who followed.
As in other witch hunts, socioeconomic and religious factors played a significant role in spurring witchcraft accusations in New Hampshire.
Spectral evidence was still in use in a case from the 1790s, a full century after the Salem witch hunt.
Dr. Pione tells us all about Eunice Cole's case and its unique historical significance.
We also discuss recent efforts to exonerate Eunice Cole.
And close with various commemorative efforts and public interests in Hampton.
We are honored to welcome Dr. Tricia Pione. Dr. Pione holds a PhD in history from the University of New Hampshire, specializing in the study of witchcraft and witch trials with a particular focus on New England.
And I am a historian. I specialize in the history of magic and witchcraft in the 17th and 18th centuries. And my job is I work at the Congregational Library and Archives, which is in Boston. And I manage a project called the New England's Hidden Histories Project, which is looking at congregational church records throughout New England and digitizing them and making them accessible by publishing them online. So I've been in that job for about a year, a little over a year. But before that, I've worked as a researcher. I've taught classes on the history of witchcraft and public history. And I did a PhD at the University of New Hampshire. And I was focusing on the history of magic and witchcraft in New England. So it is truly my favorite thing in the world to study. And I'm very lucky that right now I have a job where I get to think about Puritans all day, which not everyone would enjoy. It can be fun. We get a lot of Cotton Mather jokes at work, and occasionally we do get to do some programming about witchcraft.
That's excellent. And what drew you into the field to study witchcraft?
I have a distinct memory of being in the library at the elementary school I attended and finding a book on the Salem witch trials. And I kept returning to that book. It was a really fun book to read. And I figured out later, I tried to figure out what children's books about witchcraft were available in the 1980s to figure out what book it was that I'd been reading. And I think it was Shirley Jackson's History of the Salem Witch Trials. So I think that was the first book that caught my interest at a very young age. When I was in college, I think I was an art major for a while, and then art history, and then I switched over to history, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do exactly, but I found out that you could, in fact, study the history of witchcraft and read some of the exciting books that had come out. There's a huge flurry of publications in the 90s because of the anniversary of the Salem witch trial, so there's a lot of new research coming out about the history of witchcraft, and my interest was really piqued by that, and I did a master's in history, and I wrote about the Salem witch trials, and then went on to do a PhD in history. It's not like maybe not the best career choice for anyone or for a historian to go into witchcraft studies, but it is probably the most interesting thing that you can study, in my opinion. You'll never be bored. There's talking cats, you got ghosts, you got haunted houses. What more could you want?
Today, we're going to talk about witch trials in New Hampshire. What background do we need to know about colonial New Hampshire?
New Hampshire is kind of an outlier in New England, although I think other New England states, I think Vermont and Maine and Rhode Island and Connecticut actually could also make the same case. But New Hampshire is a little bit different than what we think about when we think of New England. And you had a great episode with Emerson Baker a while back talking about the Devil of Great Island on his New Hampshire cases. Some of your listeners probably have heard from him how unique New Hampshire is, and it's kind of a weird place on the seacoast in that period. But there are at least four cases where women face trial or some kind of court action for witchcraft in New Hampshire in the 17th century. What I think is especially interesting about New Hampshire, though, is particularly in this one case I want to tell you about, which is the case of Eunice Cole in Hampton, New Hampshire. She's charged with witchcraft a few times in the 17th century, but she has this, her story has this kind of a second life in the 20th century, because this is the first time, it's in 1938, her community, Hampton, goes through basically the first community exoneration for someone accused of witchcraft. And not a lot of people know that story, and it is really interesting. So that, I think that is one of New Hampshire's unique qualities, is that you have a community in the 1930s during the Depression that decides to revisit their past and think about what their responsibility is as a community to people who are accused of witchcraft. So no one was executed in New Hampshire for witchcraft, but there are some formal court cases, and there are at least a dozen or so other pretty interesting accusations of witchcraft that happen. The last accusation that results in the community coming together to take some action is 100 years after Salem. It's in the 1790s. So New Hampshire also provides us with some clear evidence that witchcraft continued to be a concern for people long after the Salem witch trials, even after the American Revolution.
That is a long history of witchcraft accusations. When was the first witchcraft case in New Hampshire?
Probably 1648. That's the first one we know of. And that's happening at the same time as the other early cases in New England, right? You've got 1647 and 1648 in Connecticut and Massachusetts with their first cases in court action. So 1648 in Portsmouth.
And what were primary factors that led to New Hampshire accusations?
So typical ones you'd expect, disagreements between neighbors, old grudges. Jane Walford, who's the first woman accused of witchcraft in 1648, her neighbors accused her for several decades of being a witch. Someone said they'd overheard her husband call her an old witch. Someone said they saw her turn into a cat. So those are the kinds of typical accusations you might hear. But she was pretty interesting because she took her accusers to court for slander, and she actually won. So that is one of the weird things about New Hampshire, is that at the same time as other New England colonies are going through the sort of first attempts to formalize court actions against witches, in Portsmouth, a woman accused of witchcraft is able to successfully defend her reputation. So there's a case where a physician from Boston calls her a witch, and he says he has proof, and the court actually fines for her. So they order this physician to pay her £5 for the damage to her reputation.
Wow.
So certainly unusual.
Yeah, you expect the slander cases to happen later. Owen Davies calls them the reverse witch trials.
Right.
So, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, the first case in 1648, her accusers ordered to publicly apologize to her.
Really, that early?
Yep, but that doesn't stop her. The woman accuses her again later.
Doesn't learn her lesson.
So what would have a public apology been like there? Would have that happened at a church service?
I would imagine typically it would be at a church service, although Portsmouth is a little different in that there were Anglican and Congregational churches competing for a little bit for people's attention. And the court moved around. So quarterly courts moved around. So I don't think it's clear where that public apology would have happened. But yeah, probably either in a court or the meeting house.
And how did macro scale factors like social, economic, and religious elements, how did those factors play a role in spurring witchcraft accusations?
I think in New Hampshire, you can tell those are certainly important elements to accusations. Around 1679 and 1680, when New Hampshire is officially becoming a royal colony and separating from Massachusetts, there's a little outbreak of witchcraft accusations that happens in Hampton. So you can possibly point to that as saying there's some political uncertainty going on. These cases in New Hampshire are following similar trends in the 17th century.
In New Hampshire, what influenced the proceedings in those trials?
I think that the evidence in some of these cases shows that everyone believed in magic. It's a pretty universal belief. And certainly that's true for 17th century New Hampshire. You get some interesting kind of little glimpses of what people's magical beliefs were. Like you can tell in the case, the Devil of Great Island, Emerson Baker talks about practicing counter magic. They boil urine to try to break the curse. One of the cases in Hampton shows that this woman, Rachel Fuller, who's accused of witchcraft. It sounds like she, in 1680, she'd been trying to help a sick child. Like, she'd gone to visit their house. They said that she brought some herbs with her, that she was like rubbing her hands by the fire. She spread the herbs around and she said, the child will be well. And then she told them they should plant sweet bay in front of their house to keep witches out. And then she's accused of witchcraft because the child dies. So I think that shows us that people certainly did believe in what we might call superstitions today, but they also see it as just part of their worldview. This is a way that people thought they could protect themselves, that you could plant some bay leaves by the door to keep witches out, that certain rituals and practices might help with illness. So I think the cases show both sides of that. So they're accusing people of witchcraft when things go wrong, but if things went well, if that child had recovered, Rachel Fuller probably would not have been accused of witchcraft if her alleged magic had worked.
It was just a part of daily life that magic could happen anywhere, anytime around you.
Yeah.
And that continues to be the case for many people around the world today. So you've talked a bit about some of the notable cases. You had mentioned that Jane Walford, her accuser that she took to court in 1648, that accuser came back around again to complain about her.
Yeah, Jane Walford had, I think her reputation was tarnished in the community. I think she was a bit wealthier than her neighbors, but she was widowed. Some of the testimony against her is like saying that they saw a cat. One woman testifies that her friend was being followed by a yellow cat and they couldn't catch the cat. There's a lot of testimony about cats as being suspicious, and that's what some of this evidence against her is. Her daughter was later accused of witchcraft, Hannah Jones, who was accused of witchcraft in that case with the Waltons at the Walton Tavern in Newcastle. So you do have that family connection. So I don't think Jane Walford's reputation ever was repaired, even though she was successful in court, which is interesting. Even when the courts are reluctant to convict, in New Hampshire, we could maybe say was using a different standard of evidence than Massachusetts. But that still means there's still damage to the reputation and to the family's role in the community, because her daughter was also accused of witchcraft. So even when she's wealthier, she has the power to take people to court, even taking a man to court for calling her a witch and winning, then still not really winning in the community, right? It's not going to repair those relationships.
I was wondering, what would the evidentiary standards have been in New Hampshire at that time?
They should have been following English law. They should have been using the same kinds of legal references and guidebooks as Massachusetts Bay would have been using. I have not seen any evidence from courts in New Hampshire of what they're referring to, other than referring to the law in England. So then hopefully what they want is you always want the person to confess. That's usually the best evidence. If not, you want to have two people who could testify to the seeing the same act of witchcraft, something that shows that they're involved in it with a pact with the devil, which I think is usually why they're talking about cats so much. One, because they're just suspicious of cats, but also if you can show that that cat is their animal familiar, you can find the witch's mark on their body, which is something they do in the case of Eunice Cole. They do find a mark. Then that's evidence of the pact with the devil. So that's the kind of evidence they're looking for, that's the best.
Yeah, and who isn't suspicious of cats?
I love them, but who knows what they're really up to.
Exactly.
There's a lot of talking cats in the New Hampshire cases. You see it in Salem, too. There's a few, some of the people mentioned a cat talking to them. In one of the New Hampshire cases, a little girl testifies that this gray cat offered her fancy things if she would agree to become a witch. Sounds like a good deal to me.
Yeah, those fancy things also appeared at Salem in many of the descriptions of what the devil was offering people.
Yep. Yeah, you see cases like the devil offers to help you with your chores, to buy you a new dress, to give you fancy things. So these are humble requests, I think, to make of Satan.
Yeah, we had one in Connecticut where he was sweeping the hearth.
Yeah. You would think maybe a waste of his time, but I guess not.
I know, right?
Are there any connections between New Hampshire trials and the Salem witch hunt as far as people or families?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. So Susanna Martin, who was executed during the Salem witch trial, she lived briefly in New Hampshire. She lived in Stratham for a while. And one of the first accusations against her that comes up, so we don't have evidence of it in New Hampshire, but it comes up that this is like, it happened in New Hampshire when she was living there. She's accused of infanticide and fornication and witchcraft. And this is when she was young. I think she was a servant in a house in New Hampshire and then ended up back in what's Amesbury, Massachusetts now.
And there were a few New Hampshire residents who were named during the Salem witch trials.
Yeah, and there's definitely family connections. There are people who moved from Massachusetts to New Hampshire afterwards. So yeah, there's definitely quite a few New Hampshire connections.
What kind of spectral evidence comes up in the New Hampshire accusations?
There's actually spectral evidence in one of the later cases, the case in the 1790s, that takes place in Campden, New Hampshire, which is up in the White Mountains. And it has some parallels to Salem. It's interesting because it's literally 100 years after the Salem witch trials take place. And that's a case against a woman called Polly Wiley. And the only evidence we really have about her case is a letter. So it's just this one document. It's at the New Hampshire Historical Society. And it is written by the minister, Reverend Selden Church. And he's basically, he writes this letter. It's signed by a group of 14 other men in town. So all we really have is this one document. I'm not entirely sure what happens afterwards. So we just have this one document that shows us this one moment in time. And I haven't found any other evidence really about who she was, because there's a couple people in Campden and Thornton, a neighboring town, who might have been Polly Wiley. Not 100% sure yet. So all we really have, if we take this document at face value, basically it sounds like they're responding to an accusation of witchcraft that Polly Wiley makes against several other people in the community. The men who are writing the document and signing it are saying they're not really sure if she is bewitched, if she is possessed. They don't know if she has a medical illness. So they're not really sure what is happening. But what they describe is that she's got bite marks on her. She's seeing things. And from their perspective, these are the men, these are the propertied wealthy men in the town and the minister who's the arbiter of this dispute. And what their concern is, they say it's not safe to be sure. They're not sure if it's the devil or witchcraft or a medical illness. But their concern is that people in town and people from other towns are starting to come to Polly Wiley to ask her to name the other witches in the neighborhood. Similar parallels to Salem, definitely. You have this asking someone to name witches. People are coming to her and asking her. They're trying to test her, doing some of the traditional tests of witchcraft to figure out what's going on. And so she's got these wounds and scratches all over her body. She is having these difficulties. She says she's seeing people that are invisible to everyone else in the room, but she can see them. So she's seeing these specters, and people in town want her to say who they are. So that's all we know. That's all there is. And then we have the 14 men who sign it and say they're urging caution, basically. They're saying, let's not jump to conclusions. We're not entirely sure what's happening here. It's possible that this is witchcraft. It's possible that these are specters. And so we don't know what happened after that. But it's a weird little glimpse, a little window into what was going on up in the White Mountains in the 1790s. So it's the period after the American Revolution. They're just founding this town. And there's clearly some kind of tension. And clearly some kind of maybe unexplained illnesses, some other mysterious happenings. But you have a young woman who is essentially saying that she's seeing the specters of other witches and people want more information. But the town leaders are saying, let's try to maybe put a damper on this and take a breath and figure out what's happening. Sadly, we don't know what happens, but it is definitely an interesting case.
It's really telling that 100 years after Salem, someone presenting the same symptoms as the afflicted of Salem, they urge caution now in that new era.
And so we can read it that way. And you're right. They're urging caution, but people at Salem urged caution as well. They just didn't follow it until it was too late. But we can also read it as this is a continuation of those beliefs. Just because the formal trials and executions for witchcraft have stopped in New England by that point, it doesn't it didn't necessarily stop people believing in witchcraft and believing that witches were responsible for their illness.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, around that same time in Vermont, we have one secondary source reporting on a witch accusation. And we don't get that lens of the community saying, hey, let's take caution. But we do know that she went before a committee, that mm-hmm. they wanted to test her. Was she a witch? They threw her in the river.
Right.
So here you are, 100 years later. This is two different states or colonies that it's coming up in the community, and they're not exactly sure what to make of it still.
It continues, and just because the courts aren't really interested doesn't mean people aren't interested in it. Doesn't mean communities wouldn't take action in both these cases. And I don't know, in Vermont, I don't know if the church was involved or not in arbitrating that dispute, but they certainly were in Campden in this case in the 1790s in New Hampshire. There's still this role that ministers are playing, because they are still ministers, congregational ministers anyway, still had to believe in witchcraft and ghosts part of the job.
Is there anything else about the Congregationalists really informative to witch trial history?
I think when we think about the Puritans, a lot of the ideas we have about them are they're witch hunters, they're puritanical, right? We still use that word today. But when we look at the history of witchcraft in New England, that there are people that were Congregationalists attending church regularly who believed in and sometimes practiced magic. And you see even ministers who are sometimes confused about exactly what's happening in their congregations. A lot of ministers, Cotton Mather, John Hale, they would write about their parishioners using magic, using witchcraft to harm their neighbors. And they're not always positive. What is the real cause when something unusual happens to you or happens in your community? Someone becomes unexpectedly ill. They're not always certain if it's the devil, if it's a medical illness, or if it's caused by witchcraft. And so I think that uncertainty continues definitely in through the 18th century, even the 19th century, and probably still today, right?
What are some of the primary sources or documents that have been crucial in your research?
Because New Hampshire was part of Massachusetts for much of the 17th century, a lot of the New Hampshire documents are in the Massachusetts State Archives. So Eunice Cole, I think, is the case where we have the most documentation or the most records about her. Jane Walford, there's just a little bit and some of it secondhand. But Eunice Cole, I think we have the most. There's some of her indictments, the testimonies against her survive, and they're at the Mass State Archives. And then, of course, her case is it's all over the newspapers in the 20th century. So there's a lot of really amazing illustrated newspapers and commentary about her case where you have people in the 1930s looking back at what survived from the 17th century and reinterpreting the evidence when they're trying to put forward this effort to exonerate her.
I was thinking about that community exoneration effort, and I believe they burned replicas of the court documents as a symbol of clearing her name, purifying what happened. How much additional lore has developed around her? Is she a figure of lore as well?
Yeah, so she definitely is. She's so fascinating because she was reviled by her community. They hated her in the 17th century. 3 decades, she's being brought up on charges. She's kept in jail. They send her to jail in Boston. The town has to pay for her to be in jail. There's a lot of animosity towards this woman. The evidence against her in her cases, which I think they start in her first witchcraft case, I think is in 1656. But she had faced some other charges before then. She was accused of slander. She was accused of stealing pigs. So she was known to the community to be somewhat disagreeable. So her first formal kind of accusation of witchcraft is in 1656. Her neighbors offered a lot of testimony against her. She's brought again to court in 1673. And then the final one is in 1680. So you have these three, and evidence survives from these. So we can read the testimony and see what people were saying about her. Her neighbors say things like, they saw her in church once with a mouse in her lap.
Right.
One of her neighbors says that she went to visit a sick friend, and Eunice Cole had been there the same day. She had just been there, and then the friend comes over, and the man who is sick complains and says that he saw a gray cat near his bed And then he cried out, "Lord, have mercy upon me. The cat hath killed me and broken my heart." And it was implied that Eunice Cole was the cat. So she's causing illness. They did find some really great evidence against her, but the court continued to be hesitant to convict her, but they did send her to jail. So they said that they were suspicious of her and that she should be in jail, but they were not ready to execute her. So they didn't. But at one of her trials, she was sentenced to be whipped publicly and then sent to jail, which is, I think, interesting. And when she's whipped, they see that she has a witch's teat. So she has, they see a mark under her breast that looks like it's blue, and they're not sure what it is. And they think that this is where her animal familiars, maybe the mouse, maybe the cats, are suckling from her in the night. And then they go back to look at it again to examine the mark, and she's scratched it off. So she's accused of concealing some of this great evidence against her. She's accused of enchanting an oven. So there's a lot. People say that they heard voices coming out of her house when she was alone. So she's like allegedly having conversations with Satan. She was accused, a girl accused her, a young girl who's 9 years old, Ann Smith, said that she had tried to entice her, that Eunice Cole offered her plums to come and live with her. And the girl said no. And Eunice Cole pushed her and hit her with a rock. So Eunice Cole runs away. A cat appears in her place. This is when the cat offers the girl fine things if she will go and live with Eunice Cole, but she doesn't. There's tons, there's overwhelming evidence, but they found that she wasn't legally guilty in spite of this testimony, but that there was just ground of vehement suspicion of her for having had familiarity with the devil. It's cyclical in the community. What's going on? Let's accuse Eunice Cole of witchcraft again. She's in and out of jail. She comes back to town. Her husband dies. She becomes a town charge. And when she dies, according to town legend, they found her in her shack and they buried her body with a stake through her heart and then a horseshoe around the stake so that her spirit wouldn't be able to escape and haunt them. However, the town folklore also says that her ghost still haunts and walks the streets of Hampton. And so people have said that they've seen her over the years. And to this day, allegedly, her ghost is unsettled and upset. And so that was part of the justification for exonerating her, was to appease her ghost. So her whole reputation goes through a rehabilitation starting in the 19th century, because in the 19th century, you get more of the sort of romantic idea of Puritans and witchcraft. So she's in a John Greenleaf Whittier poem. He writes about her in a poem called The Wreck of the River Mouth. And in that poem, she's kind of sympathetic. Like, yeah, she caused the shipwreck, but she felt bad about it, right? And it was because people were cruel to her. So in the 19th century, the stories you have about Eunice Cole are more that she was maybe a little rough around the edges, but that basically the community was mean to her and had wronged her. It's such a fascinating case. So then by the time you get to the 20th century, the community decides, and I'm not totally sure where the motivation comes from in the community to do this rehabilitation and create this monument, but it comes up around the 300th anniversary of the town. So 1938 is the 300th anniversary of the English founding of Hampton. And so at town meeting that year, the citizens get together and they vote to exonerate her. And they say they're going to create this memorial. It's not totally clear like why they want to do this, but what they say, to take it with a grain of salt, is they say in a newspaper article from 1938, they say the reason for the exoneration was part of the current revolt against the Puritan tradition. So that's what some of the people involved were saying, that it's a rejection of the Puritan past. But why in 1938? That's one of the kind of unanswered questions. So they have town meeting in March of 1938. The residents vote on an article, and the article says, quote, "We, the citizens of the town of Hampton, do hereby declare that we believe that Eunice Cole was unjustly accused of witchcraft and familiarity with the devil in the 17th century, and we do hereby restore her to her rightful place as a citizen of the town of Hampton." And then she resolved that they would celebrate her during the 300th anniversary that summer, that they would have these ceremonies, which, as you mentioned, it's when they decide to publicly burn the certified copies of the documents from her various trials. And then they take the ashes from those documents and they take some soil from where she had lived, some soil from the earth, and they mix them together and they put them in an urn And then they said they were going to bury that on the town green, but it's actually in the Tuck Museum. So you can go see that and see some of these artifacts from her, from the case of Eunice Cole in Hampton. But it sounds very ritualistic, right? Like they're doing, it sounds a little bit like sorcery to me, like burning these documents symbolically, mixing them with earth, burying them. But that's what they did. And then they declared August 25th of 1938 to be Goody Cole Day. They always call her Goody Cole, like the Puritan address, Good Wife. So short for Good Wife, Goody Cole. They had a pageant. They reenacted some of her trials. Okay. Dramatizing the events. Like someone wrote a play and the town all comes and they listen to this reenactment of the events. There are speeches. There's a big party. There's the Hampton Beach Bandstand. 3,000 people attend the ceremony. It's covered in the national news. It got a fair amount of attention. Famous people were there, government officials. They created a commemorative coin and a doll that like is supposed to look like Goody Cole. Again, slightly witchy. But yeah, and you can see those things also at the Tuck Museum. They have the urn, they have the doll, they have the coins. And there's pictures online if you want to see them. So these efforts are all being led by this group, and the group calls themselves the Society in Hampton for the Apprehension of Those Falsely Accusing Goody Cole for Having Familiarity with the Devil. And they made membership cards to be in this society. Not like a catchy name, really, but that's what they went with. And so they're making the coin, they make the doll. They're rehabilitating her public image. And it's a moment in New Hampshire history where New Hampshire could have been the site of witchcraft tourism. Before Salem really took that on, it could have been Hampton, New Hampshire. And apparently there was some witchcraft-based tourism in the 1930s and afterwards. People visited one of the alleged sites where she had lived, and they come to see this huge event at the bandstand on the beach. Quite an amazing story. They promised to build a memorial in 1938. They actually didn't. They didn't leave anything permanent after that ceremony. But then in 1963, the town placed a boulder on the town green. And then they put the plaque there at the town's 375th anniversary, which was in 2013. So there is a marker on the town green that you can go and see. But compared to the other markers in New England, this one gets very little attention, right? Literally hundreds of thousands of people will walk through the city of Salem and see the witchcraft memorials there. And very few people know about Eunice Cole or visit her marker.
Eunice was not a confessor. She didn't confess.
She did not confess, and she was not executed, yet there is a marker. Yeah.
And what about some of these other stories that we talked about today? Do they have markers or historical sites that are remembered today?
The only marker about witchcraft in New Hampshire is Eunice Cole's boulder on the town green in Hampton. There are other kind of informal markers. There's Witch Creek, which runs through Portsmouth, and that name appears on maps, still like USGS maps today. And it's most likely because of Jane Walford. The area where she lived is where the creek runs through. So that's more informal. But yeah, the only monument to witchcraft in New Hampshire is Eunice Cole's boulder. Although in the 1570s, there was a museum of witchcraft in New Hampshire. But that's a whole other story. It's not there anymore. It was only there for a few years. It was up at Weir's Beach in Laconia.
And Goody Cole's memory has lived on. And there was an effort to exonerate her just last year.
Yeah, I didn't hear as much about the recent effort, but back before the pandemic, one of the state reps from Hampton, Rennie Cushing, had started that effort. And I talked to him a little bit about it at the time, but then he's sadly died since then. And I think the pandemic too. So I actually haven't seen if what the state house actually decided to do in this case. So if you have an article, you could send me. I'd actually love to read it because I haven't seen if they formally do anything. Because it's a weird case because technically it was Massachusetts that convicted her.
It passed the house, but then in the Senate, it was voted down by party lines 14-10. And yeah, but there is potential for legislation in Massachusetts that would clear her. So she's definitely not been forgotten.
Oh, keep following it because it's interesting to think about the fact that Hampton, before any other community, so before Massachusetts exonerated anyone or Connecticut, Hampton did it in 1938, and they did it through a town article. The town passed it. It wasn't the state, but they did it on a town level. Have you seen other towns that have taken action like that? Because I think it's mostly been on the state level.
Yeah, Windsor, Connecticut has, and Stratford, Connecticut did just last fall.
Interesting.
With Goody Bassett there.
Yeah, I think these local community exonerations are so important to building that history at that local level. I think it's really important to see towns who have these connections to these stories rehabilitating the reputations.
It is fascinating to me that New Hampshire did it first, right? Bizarre. That's what happened. And the other, it was contentious. Like, not everyone in the community agreed in 1938. That's what they wanted to do. One of the descendants of someone who had accused Eunice Cole of witchcraft wrote to the town and was like, you can't overturn her conviction. You can't publicly say that she wasn't a witch because that disparages my ancestor. His ancestor had accused her of being a witch because she had cursed his cattle, he said. So he objected. And the town had to go through this PR process with him to get him to come to the ceremony. So this ancestor, one of her accusers, did attend the ceremony and agreed to like not make a big fuss. But there were articles in the newspaper about it. Not everyone in the community agreed that they should exonerate someone accused multiple times by many people of witchcraft 300 years later.
But isn't that such a great example of how, even though we fear, how does this hurt the accusers, their descendants, or if we're looking at some kind of judgment from the state that just wasn't just, if we're going to make things right for the innocent, what are we, what is that saying about the authority, or what does that do to the reputation of others? And I think that is an example in other communities that have come together through those questions, that you can look at these hard histories and everybody can come full circle and move forward with this acknowledgement of, hey, some things are not right here, but we want to make them right. And that's such a huge impact for others today.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And I think that also shows the importance of when a community or on the state level, local or state, like when they're going through this process, to think about who all the stakeholders are, to think about not just the descendants of the accused, but the descendants of the accusers and having them be part of the process. Because I think a lot of the people who have a genetic connection to the Salem witch trials might be on both sides, like you said, right, Josh? Like you said, like you have both accusers and accused.
Right. I have accusers and accused, and I have ancestors who were obviously conflicted about the witch trials. My grandfather, Joseph Hutchinson, 9th great-grandfather, he was one of the first accusers who signed the first complaint against Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne. But then later on, he signed the petition in defense of Rebecca Nurse. So he seems to have changed his mind over the course of the trials. And I think there's a lot of stories like that. And like you said, genetically, if you're related to one of the accused, because they're all contributing to the same gene pool, the accused and the accuser families intermarried so much in the following generations that you're likely to have ancestors on both sides.
In Connecticut, there was an anonymous descendant who wanted to see exoneration for the accused who descended from accusers. So you have descendants of accusers who feel both ways. And you mentioned stakeholders. We are all stakeholders in this. I think that's why it keeps coming up, because we're the stakeholders of the dignity of humans. And what do we know about it today? And what can we learn from the bad things that happened in these courtrooms? Then let's look at them. Let's look at these stories, the humanity there, and have a different chapter ahead, not the same chapters flipping through the stories that we're seeing on the news now that are too similar.
I would like to know more about your job. What can you tell us about New England's Hidden Histories?
So New England's Hidden Histories is a project that the Congregational Library and Archives has been working on for quite a while. And it's creating a digital archive to preserve and provide access to all early congregational church records in New England. So if you go on the Congregational Library and Archives website, you can find New England's Hidden Histories. And currently, there are records from more than 100 churches, and as well as collections of personal papers. So we've got a lot of Cotton Mather's papers and his father, some Increase Mather papers as well. And the purpose is some of these records are, for one, they're really community records, right? Because in Massachusetts, for example, the Congregational Church was the established church for a very long time. And sometimes a church record book, it's not just baptisms, marriages, it's not just the kind of genealogical information that's interesting for people looking for family members and their ancestry. It's also town meeting records. It's also tax records. Like these, the church and state were very intertwined in the 17th and 18th century. And so these records tell a lot of really fascinating stories. There are, you can find stories about ministers who enslaved people. You can find about churches who purchased enslaved people to pay part of the salaries of their ministers. So there are stories of slavery. There are stories of people confessing to all sorts of things. They would give public confessions in congregational churches, these relations of faith, to talk about their experiences. And you will often have people talking about whether it's like fornication or adultery, whatever sins they are committing. And those are some of the, I think, most interesting from my perspective records that you can read is these 18th century people confessing their sins to their entire community. But it also demonstrates, again, like the things we see with the Salem witch trials of the importance of confession. So we talk about that for the Salem witch trials. That's what really what people wanted to hear. They wanted that confession of witchcraft and that it has not just this legal meaning, but also a social and a spiritual meaning. And so you can read people's confessions of all sorts of things, occasionally witchcraft, but other things as well. So yeah, so it's a digital archive that is seeking to put together the records from congregational churches from all six New England states.
And what's the most recent date that is covered in that project?
We try to go up to about 1850. So we've got records from the 1620s through about 1850.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, because my ancestors were all in the congregational church right down to my grandfather, who was a member of the first congregational church in Danvers.
I think we have some Danvers and Salem church records. Yeah. It's really fun. It's always fun to see. It's not always a ton of information, but you might see, oh, he was at this meeting and they elected him to be a church official or a deacon, or just seeing people's records of their marriage records. It's interesting to see it. To see the original, to see the actual 17th and 18th century hand of someone recording this information is always, I think it's always fun. It's a way of connecting with the past when you actually can look at these volumes.
Definitely. Yeah, I've seen the seating arrangements in those records before.
Yep.
Yeah, it gets pretty detailed about everything that went on in that community, especially around the church.
Yeah, Congregationalists and New Englanders were amazing record keepers.
Yeah, thankfully for us.
So what survives is really interesting. It's fun to think too about what didn't survive, right? Like we know that there are more records of witchcraft that were destroyed. And still new things turn up every once in a while. You'll find new documents. So we might not even know of all of the New England witchcraft cases yet.
That's very true. Is there anything else that you wanted to discuss today?
I told you about Eunice Cole. I think that's really the most interesting New Hampshire story is Eunice Cole. And then, yeah, I think the Polly Wiley case too, of this kind of 100 years of Salem. It's a similar case, but goes in a different direction. The other interesting thing about New Hampshire, I think, is that in the 1970s, there was this museum of witchcraft. Again, another opportunity for Hampton to be a witchy tourist destination that just didn't happen. So that's a much more modern story, so probably not as interesting. But I do think this, the case in Hampton with this, the sort of the reinterpretation and the cleansing of Eunice Cole's reputation and how she changes in public memory over time, from being the most hated woman in the community to being a tragic romantic figure to being almost a local legend hero status. Someone who was very defiant of authority. She bit a constable. She was disagreeable, but plucky, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she had moxie.
Is it? Exactly.
Spirit. Yeah. And it did, when you were describing the 1938 ceremony, it sounded like a ritual of atonement and maybe appeasement. I was wondering, in the 1930s, that's the Great Depression era, were they literally trying to appease and atone for what they did? Who knows?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I want to find some more, see if there are any more records. I've seen the newspaper accounts talking about it, but I wonder if there are any other personal accounts to find still that kind of are people talking about why they felt this need, because it's an outlier. You have the 1990s where everyone revisits the Salem witch trials. You have the 1880s, I think, is when they first start putting up some of the monuments to Rebecca Nurse and John Proctor, and that's coming from families who are doing that in the 1880s, 1890s. And then there's this gap. And then it's 1938, this community gets together in New Hampshire. And I think, yeah, I think they're trying to absolve the town of guilt through their efforts. But at the same time, they're trying to make a profit, right? They're saying, like, come to Hampton, come to the beach, buy a doll, get a commemorative coin, come give us your tourism dollars. It's the Depression. We need it. I think there's a couple of different angles to that story.
That's good. It's a good marketing strategy, whether that was the intent or not.
I'm fascinated, too, that they're saying in the newspaper that they're trying to reject this Puritan past 300 years after the settlement of the town. I think Puritans are always being reassessed.
And now for A Minute with Mary.
Sarah Parker was accused of the capital crime for which her mother, Mary, hanged in 1692 at Salem, Massachusetts, British America, witchcraft. However, Sarah was not legally condemned. Still, Sarah suffered the same environment as those who stood trial. After her arrest, she lived at the Salem jail for 17 weeks, where she experienced the suffering and sickness of her neighbors. It was here that Sarah was told of her mother's death, leaving her to grieve in isolation and fear her own fate. She was eventually released from jail. In 1710, Sarah's brothers added her jail fees into their accounts when they filed a petition for restitution for their mother. Only Mary's fees were reimbursed. In 1712, Sarah filed a petition on her own behalf. She was denied. Sarah's trauma in 1692 was due in large part by the actions of the government. Today, the state of Massachusetts owes Sarah Parker and the Parker family a sincere apology.
Thank you, Mary.
Sarah has End Witch Hunts News.
End Witch Hunts, a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Weekly news update. The Massachusetts Witch Hunt Justice Project is a project of End Witch Hunts. This project continues its vital mission, building on previous legislative successes that acknowledge the convictions of the Salem witch trials. Yet, a significant number of individuals, notably 5 executed in Boston and others accused, still lack formal recognition from the Massachusetts General Court for the injustices they endured. The Massachusetts witch trials occurred between 1638 and 1693. During this period of 55 years, at least 254 individuals were accused of witchcraft in Massachusetts. 209 of these were complained of, implicated in court, questioned, arrested, and/or imprisoned. The other 45 were defamed, named socially, but not complained of legally, or have been linked to witchcraft accusations by incomplete evidence. 37 people were indicted apart from Salem, and 81 were indicted during the Salem witch hunt of 1692 to 1693. To learn more day-by-day history on the 1692-1693 Salem Witch Trials, follow our social media channels and tune into the live Salem Witch Hunt Daily Report hosted by Josh. In addition to the 24 individuals executed by hanging and the one pressed to death in 1692, At least six others arrested for witchcraft perished while in jail, including the infant sister of Dorothy Good. Also, to date, the eight convicted in Boston have not been acknowledged. No official apology by the Massachusetts General Court has ever been issued for the witch trials or to the victims. This justice has been delayed for over 300 years. To quote Dr. King, justice delayed is justice denied. Our goal is to secure legislative recognition for all prosecuted under various colonial governments in Massachusetts. Suggesting an amendment to the 1957 resolve could be a viable approach. This amendment would honor victims like Tituba and the accused child witch Dorothy Good, among others, who endured significant trauma and injustice. As highlighted today by Mary Louise Bingham's observations, Massachusetts victims such as Sarah Parker sought exoneration from the Massachusetts General Court, the very institution we approach today. This historical body once presided over witchcraft prosecutions in the 17th century, and it failed to exonerate Sarah. Now, we stand as her representatives, appealing to the current Massachusetts General Court, today ruled by the House and the Senate, to rectify these past wrongs. We invite you to join the Massachusetts Witch Hunt Justice Project by signing our petition, volunteering, or making a donation. Your involvement, whether by sharing our content, discussing these issues in your networks, or urging leaders to act, is invaluable. Together, we can nurture values of compassion, understanding, and justice in our world. Support our mission by becoming a financial donor. Visit witchhuntshow.com to donate any amount you're comfortable with. Your generosity is the backbone of the podcast content you value. Let's commit to making a difference together.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome, Josh.
And thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
Please join us next week.
Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
Visit us at witchhuntshow.com.
And remember to tell all your friends.
Support our efforts to end witch hunts. Visit endwitchhunts.org to learn more.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.